Hello, I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is an accomplished woman. She's been a trailblazer for women and African Americans in the corporate world and garnered many awards and achievements along the way. Yet despite all of that, she says she's been plagued by self-doubt and what she calls imposter syndrome. She says this is quite common among successful and accomplished people, and she joins us today to talk about her experience and about her new book. Joyce Roche is the author of The Empress Has No Clothes, Conquering Self-Doubt to Embrace Success. Joyce, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, first of all, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your career trajectory, so we can understand what you've done so far.
Sure, absolutely. I grew up in New Orleans and went all the way through undergraduate school in New Orleans, and then moved to New York to go to Columbia to get my MBA. Which was the first experience I had in business, and learned about marketing, which led me on the path, the career path that I took. I started in an entry-level position with Avon Products in New York City, and spent almost 19 years at Avon, a brief stint at Revlon in between for 2 years, but all told about 19 years at Avon. Started in an entry-level position and worked my way up to become the senior vice president of marketing, and then ultimately the vice president of global marketing for Avon. I left Avon at the end of 1994, joined with an investor group that bought a hair care company in Savannah, Georgia, and I was president of that company. It's Carson Products, which was later acquired by L'Oreal. And then after almost 25 years in corporate, I decided to make a very, very different career change. And this was after a lot of thinking and soul searching. I decided that I really wanted to, at that point, do something that would not only stimulate my mine, but also, in a sense, fuel my passion and my soul. And that's when I moved out of corporate and became the CEO of Girls Incorporated, which is the old Girls Clubs of America. So it's almost 150-year-old organization that's just its mission is to empower girls to be strong, smart, and bold. So it's been doing great work for girls in this country, hundreds and thousands of girls in this country for a very long time. So toward the end of 2010, as I stepped down from Girls Inc. and then began to consider this idea of doing a book, The Empress Has No Clothes, Conquering Self-Doubt to Embrace Success. And that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. So what inspired you to do that? It sounds like this thing you call imposter syndrome has plagued you throughout your career. And why is
that?
Well,
yeah, it's an interesting, I really didn't know this term, imposter syndrome, and it wasn't one that I coined. In fact, there was research done by two psychotherapists, Dr. Pauline Clance and Dr. Suzanne Imes, in 1978 with 150 highly successful women, where they observed these very accomplished women who still doubted their abilities even in the face of success. But anyway, the way I got onto this road and the road of the book was in 2005, I contributed to a book called What I Know Now, Letters to My Younger Self. And Ellen Spragan, who was the author of that book, asked me this question, as she did of the 30 other women in the book: if you could talk to your 30-year-old self with the knowledge that you have today, what would you say? And when I thought about that, my letter reflected my time in corporate America, where I was moving up in the corporation and being successful, but I realized that I really wasn't enjoying the journey. And the reason I wasn't enjoying the journey was every time I was promoted or moved to a new area of responsibility, this voice of self-doubt would start, and it would say, you're going to stumble this time, and they're going to find out that you shouldn't be here. They're going to say, we knew we shouldn't have given her that chance. We knew she couldn't cut it. We knew she didn't fit in. And so that little voice that would start would cause me to work really long hours, to over-prepare for everything, because I always felt like I had to work to prove that I deserved to be in that new position. So in the context of that, as opposed to feeling wonderful about these accomplishments and enjoying this time, that was very short-lived. And so I realized my letter said basically that I wasn't enjoying the journey. And if I had known back then what I know today, I would have said to myself, relax, you deserve to be here. And when I did that, when I contributed that letter, it was reprinted in O Magazine along with three others from that book, and I received tons of emails and notes from people, many I didn't know, who said, you're telling my story. You need to do a book. And so I was still heavily involved in my work at Girls, Inc., but when I stepped down, I decided, wow, maybe this is the time that if, in fact, that message in that book resonated with so many people, that if I step back and could do a book that really talked even more about the struggles that I had and some of the techniques, as well as talking to other people that I knew who were successful, who I learned also were challenged at times with this self-doubt or the imposter syndrome, that if I could put that in a book and help people who are currently in their careers realize first that they're not alone, because this is something where you, in a sense, internalize it, and nobody externally, you look very confident, and no one would ever suspect that there's this churning going on inside of you. So, one, to recognize that they aren't alone, and two, to give them, help them understand some of the ways of what I call internally validating yourself, giving your understanding the value that you're bringing to the party and being able to enjoy that journey of your career. So that's basically how and why the book came about.
At what point, though, did you stop and recognize that you suffered from imposter syndrome and actually was able to snap out of it, I guess, and tell yourself to snap out of it?
Well, as I said, I don't know that I consciously recognized it until I contributed to that book. But I do know that there was a point in time that I can recall, and one of the first times that I can recall that I started to really, in a sense, recognize my value and my worth. And this really happened when I was at Avon, and I had been at Revlon, as I said, for a couple of years as director of marketing there and was recruited back to Avon. And one of the things is when I was recruited back in discussions with the senior officers there was that I, based upon the experience I had gained from this, you know, competitive company and the experience I had at Avon, it would position me well when a new vice presidential role came up. Well, I went back to Avon. There was no question about the company. That was not the reason I left, but it was to gain different kind of experience. So I looked forward to moving back, but also this promise of the possibility of, I shouldn't say promise, but the possibility of becoming a vice president, someone, there hadn't been anybody who looked like me who had achieved that role in the marketing organization, I thought was, you know, quite exciting. And so I was there, I think a little under 2 years I was back, and the first vice president of marketing position was opening up and had been announced because my vice president was moving out of the U.S. to one of the countries, and so we knew that this was going to happen in a relatively short period of time. Well, what happened at that stage, though, all of a sudden there was a male colleague of mine who I, in fact, had recruited and brought into the company was being groomed for that position or was, in a sense, quote-unquote, heir apparent. And I just thought, oh, my goodness, here I've come back. I've proven, I've worked hard, I've accomplished, I've achieved the goals that were there and gone even beyond. And here's the opportunity that I've been waiting to have happen, and it's basically, it doesn't appear that I'm even being considered. So at that point, I had to recognize that I had to be the voice of my value. And so I made an appointment with my senior officer and just asked the question if, in fact, the plan was to put the other person in that slot. And he asked me to talk about my own accomplishments and my experience and et cetera, and versus both this particular person and another male colleague. And I discussed where I thought, you know, their strengths were, where my strengths were, and that I thought I measured up very, very well, and in fact, a little stronger in some instances. And essentially, the company made a structural change and promoted both of us to vice presidents at the same time. But it was the first time that I had actually vocalized and also internalized my value and my accomplishments. So that was probably the first big trigger that I can remember.
Hmm. Well, and it's an interesting paradox that you draw, too, because what I'm hearing is that you all at once knew that you were the most qualified for the job and that you were up for the challenge, but you still, maybe even after you were given that promotion, did you still feel like you were an imposter? And what underlies that? If you know that you're good at what you do, then why feel that way?
Well, in fact, it probably got a little, it's crazy, but it got a little magnified because here I was, I had vocalized now that I was ready for this and that I could do this. And now it immediately came and I started questioning, oh my goodness, now am I really up to this task? Can I really achieve, you know, this other area of responsibility, this higher level of responsibility, competing in a different group than I had ever competed in before. And so it immediately came back, and it immediately caused me to say, okay, you're going to have to, you know, is it possible to even work any harder? You know, you've got to really push to prove that, in fact, what you said you can really meet, that you can really do this. So... And I knew there was a great deal of press surrounding the fact that I had become Avon's first female African-American female vice president. So there was the external out there and the internal in a sense where, in fact, I felt like not only did I have to prove it and prove that I could do it, but if, in fact, if I failed, it would not just be a personal failure. It could potentially be a failure for anybody else who looked like me, who got to that position and was ready, would they be given the chance?
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, it put even greater, the dial got dialed up a little bit more, in fact, after that.
Do you find that, I guess anecdotally, I don't know that there's been any, or has there been any scientific research on whether women suffer from imposter syndrome more than men?
Well, I spoke with, in fact, when I decided to do the book, I said, well, I'm going to just try and reach out to one of the two women who did that original research, and I reached out to Dr. Clance and asked her that question, and also there was some information on the site, and I think they did later research that, in a sense, showed that men suffer with this, as do women. And probably not that women don't, you know, it's not significantly greater, more women suffer with it than men, but men just tend not to be as vocal about it as women who mm-hmm. then, you know, recognize that this thing is going on. So it doesn't seem to be gender specific at all. And that was really in writing the book and the people I asked, who I talked about, the fact that I was writing this book, and I was hopeful that, in fact, if they did struggle or had struggled with the imposter syndrome, they would be willing to contribute a story to the book. I specifically sought out men as well because I wanted the message in the book to be that it is not just women who suffer with this, and it's not just people of color. So I've got Caucasians and I've got African Americans in the book. So I wanted that message that the trigger, and this is one of the things I realized as I reached out to different people who agreed to participate, whether it was Rick Goings, who's the CEO of Tupperware, or Ed Whitaker, who's was the retired CEO of AT&T, or an Eileen Fisher, the designer, or Debbie Lee, who's the CEO of BET, that there are different triggers, but the common element that seemed to work in this process is that the trigger happens when you find yourself being, in a sense, in the minority of a different kind of group. You're the one that is different. And so what I mean by that is, let's say a woman who is functioning in a predominantly male environment, that can definitely be a trigger, where in fact she starts to internalize this question, or the self-doubt comes there of, am I going to be able to fit in with this group? Can I show that in fact I can compete at the same level? Similar kind of thing as someone who is a person of color, who is finding themselves competing in or engaging in a majority environment, similar kind of thing. Or as I saw with people like Rick Goings, it was economic status. Growing up, as he did, with a family of modest means and starting his own company and then ultimately becoming a CEO, but finding himself, after he was successful, competing with people or engaging with people who grew up around, as he says, horse farms and coming out parties and country clubs, something that he had no experience in his growing up. And the question that in the back of his head was basically, do I fit in with this group? Can I fit in with this group?
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Joyce Roche. She's author of The Empress Has No Clothes, Conquering Self-Doubt to Embrace Success. What about you? Have you suffered from imposter syndrome? Do you know what triggered it? Are you suffering from it now? Do you need some advice? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or find us on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Coming up after the break, we'll talk more about what's behind imposter syndrome, what's triggering it, and how to actually overcome it. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Joyce Roche, author of The Empress Has No Clothes, Conquering Self-Doubt to Embrace Success. We want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Do Joyce's experiences resonate with you? Do you feel like you suffer from imposter syndrome? How so? You can let us know. Our email address as well is talk@WPR.org. Joyce, you mentioned earlier the letter you wrote to your younger self, and I wanted to pick out a little piece of it. You wrote that the threat of failure scares you into working long hours, yet success only intensifies the fear of discovery. I want to talk a little bit, digging into the fear of failure. How does one tell oneself that failure is okay? How do you set a healthy threshold for that?
Well, I think that it is the drive that goes along with it. As I talk about the imposter syndrome, that drive to show or to prove that you deserve to be in whatever it is often causes you to, in a sense, push through the concerns about failure and to, in a sense, take the risks that might be in that path. Of course, I would say that, you know, you assess it in the context of what is the downside to making this particular move or pursuing this particular thing. And try and understand that, but at the same time, the drive to ensure that the message gets there, that I know that I can do this thing, I can prove to you I can do this thing, counters the fear of that it's a fear of failure that keeps driving you and pushing you to do this. So in a sense, it's kind of a catalyst in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things, people will often ask, well, is two questions. One, what's the difference between the imposter syndrome and insecurity? And I said, well, someone who's insecure, it's usually in terms of an ability that they feel they lack. And that concern of that lack in ability will often cause the person who's very insecure not to take a risk,
mm-hmm.
because that is too, you know, they really don't feel that it's that they've got the skill or the qualities to do it. Someone from with the imposter syndrome may feel that, in fact, there may be a skill question in there, because, again, I'm wondering if I can fit and achieve at this new higher level. But the fact that I am in this position, the driver is that I've got to prove. So I work to prove that, in fact. So it doesn't stop you. It keeps the momentum going. It doesn't cause the momentum to stop. So that's why I say it's somewhat as a catalyst to counter the fear of failure, in a sense.
Mm. Well, how do we know the difference between experiencing normal nerves of taking on a new challenge versus the symptoms of imposter syndrome? And what's the difference?
Yeah, well, you know, to some degree, and I mentioned this in the book, looking at a new opportunity, a promotion, a new area of responsibility, it's a natural reaction to, you know, initial reaction to wonder whether or not you can perform at that. So that's kind of a natural reaction, and it's one that, as you think about it and think about how you got there and what are the positives that you have, what are the things maybe you'll have to work a little bit harder on, but you're saying, you know, you're in a sense, you're realizing that nobody walks into an absolutely new thing and has all the answers. With the imposter syndrome, I think what the question is that if that initial reaction does not abate, but it stays with you, and your reaction to that is to say, okay, I'm going to have to work harder. I'm going to have to put in more hours. I'm going to have to over-prepare for everything. I'm going to have to constantly show that I can do this, and I can match up to whatever it is. So that, and often what happens in the context of that is there's the potential for, well, there's a high stress level for sure. The second thing is this potential for physical impact, as well as I, you know, observed in myself and some of the people I talked to, it had personal consequences, because you start to compromise other aspects of your life because you're so driven to, in fact, in a sense, prove that you can be there. It's a different kind of thing that's going on.
Well, we have plenty of people who want to talk to you about this. Let's go first to Eric in Portage. Hi, Eric.
Hello. You know, I have a situation like that. I'm smart and I work very hard. I'm very skilled, better at than most people at what I do. You know, I don't see trying as failure. I don't think I could fail in a business if I tried. And everything I do works out, yet I over-prepare for everything and I feel like an imposter. So what do I do about that?
Well, Eric, you've described it, basically, that the fear is there, yet you prove you can do it, and then the fear comes back because now you've gotten another opportunity because you drove and over-prepared and overworked and all the things to show that you could do what you could do, and now it's been rewarded again. And so then you get the cycle starts again. I think the first thing, which I applaud you on, is first recognizing it, because that is the first thing that I tell people is don't be silent. I was silent for a very long time. It is something that we keep inside because externally we don't want anybody to know that the churn is going on. But that, so we give out, our external is very much of a confident person. So find someone that you can chat with about it, or a coach, or as I did, writing down on a piece of paper just exactly how I was feeling. And what were the things that caused me to feel that way? And what was I trying to prove? And who was I trying to prove it to? Secondly, to take a real honest assessment of the skills, your unique skills. What are you bringing to the party? What are the things, what are your experiences? What are your accomplishments that validate, in a sense, validate for you internally that you deserve to be there, that you can, in fact, achieve in this new position that you're in. Take a look at the people who you're comparing yourself to. They're not perfect. You know, they have positives just like you do and unique skills, but at the same time, they've got some things that they probably are not great at or lack as well. So it's not that you're coming up short. Everybody, nobody's perfect. So being able to take that, getting a reality check on yourself, but also being looking realistically at the people that you're competing with and that you're concerned whether or not you measure up.
How does that sound, Eric?
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Yeah, you mentioned that talking to someone about it might help. Do you find that men have a harder time doing that than women?
I think that is clearly. I don't have any research evidence, but I would say, just in terms of my own observation, as I've talked about this, women are much more willing to then, when you describe how you're feeling or what it is, to say, you know, I have that same thing, or let me just tell you about a situation that I'm dealing with. With men, they tend to be much quieter, not to really be forthcoming. And often in the events where I've talked about the book, it's usually after, and someone, a male will come up and he'll say, you know, I really have, I've dealt with that. I grew up with a family, da-da-da-da, or I've had this kind of situation, but they tend not to be as willing to express it. I think it's perceived as, you know, as a weakness, and we want to be always that strong, confident individual.
Right. So there's that, and also maybe the fear that by saying, I feel like an imposter, you might be outing yourself as an imposter, even though you're not. Let's go next to Peter in Baraboo. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Thanks for the call. I really appreciate the conversation. My sense is that in some way, shape, or form, every human being feels to be an imposter in a new situation. You become a parent. You're in a new situation. You look around. Everybody seems to know everything but you. You enter the workforce. You learn skills. You feel like you're an imposter. In my career, 6 or 7 different aspects, from teaching to consulting to skills management, I've always found in looking back that the people who hired me had a faith in me and a support in me that gave me a sense of security about my own abilities to succeed. And in looking back, I've always felt when I hired new people with new skills, I never would have been hired for the position that I'm hiring people for. So that imposter syndrome, I think, is a part of our human condition. Some people deal with it by bluffing or by being more aggressive and more forceful. Other people, I think, deal with it in being less forward and less directive. But I think it's a natural part of who human beings are to have that concern. And thank you so much for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Peter.
Oh, thank you.
So would you agree, is imposter syndrome just sort of a natural human condition?
Well, I think that probably the natural human condition is that almost everyone at some point, let's say, at some point may have had the feeling. The imposter syndrome is when, in fact, it's a constant. And that it's not just, okay, I was in this situation and I learned it. As Ed, you know, when I talked to Ed Whitaker and he made the comment, and I completely concurred with him, is that it never goes away. It never goes away. You learn how to quiet the voice, and you learn how to quiet that voice faster. But each new situation will trigger it. So it's. I think that the normal human condition is that, you know, at some point most people will say, yeah, you know, I found myself in this particular situation, and I really didn't feel like I was up to snuff, and I had to really fake it. That's a one-time scenario, but when it's a constant, when that voice, when you recognize that voice, and you know, and as experience and techniques teach you how to quiet it, but it will find its way back, and I think that's the difference.
You say that we should become familiar with our imposter. What do you mean by that?
Well, know the triggers,
mm-hmm.
And understand the triggers, because if it is, you know, that if you know that, in fact, this new situation where I'm competing with people who are different, and I mean the majority of the population that I'm competing with or engaging with, are different, significantly different than I am or my experiences, then understanding, and that's becoming familiar with your imposter, understanding that and then learning how to then do those reality checks. Step away from it. Step back. Take a deep breath. Step back and assess, why is the voice starting? What is it about this situation? What is it about that I'm feeling that I'm lacking so significantly at this particular time? And what kind of evidence do I have to assure myself that I can compete or engage or be a part of this? So it's really recognizing that voice and understanding how to then start to internally validate yourself in the process.
We're talking with Joyce Roche, author of The Empress Has No Clothes, Conquering Self-Doubt to Embrace Success. Coming up after the break, we'll talk about how to actually turn external validation into internal and how to use that as a means of overcoming imposter syndrome. You can give us a call with your questions and comments, your personal experiences at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or tweet us on Twitter. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Joyce Roche, author of The Empress Has No Clothes, Conquering Self-Doubt to Embrace Success. Joyce, just before the break, you're talking about how to turn those external praises and validations into internal validation, and you call that metabolizing the validation. Can you talk more about how that's done?
Well, I think the first step is actually, excuse me, doing that reality check. It may be just as simple as, and I did do this, is kind of doing a list, you know, of your qualities, your skills, your experiences, your accomplishments, and looking at those, because that's where you start to be able to understand the unique elements that you bring to the party. You're able to then describe, in a sense, internally to yourself why, in fact, you can do this new thing, whatever that new thing happens to be. And also, I think it's this process of when, in fact, you are complimented from an external source on something you've done well or an accomplishment that you've achieved, we tend to have that kind of knee-jerk reaction to just say, it wasn't a big deal, or anybody could have done it, or, yeah, I was really lucky. Well, instead, you know, let it sink in and then basically say thank you, because that starts to, again, allow you to internally validate you. And that you're really hearing what someone's saying. You're not discounting what they're saying just because it's an uncomfortable position to be in.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have any questions or thoughts for us. We'll go next to Mary in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I have a question, please. Maybe you could help me. I have a friend whose husband is the self-pusher. And he is not self-reflective, but he has this having to achieve syndrome. And my friend doesn't know how to deal, respond best.
Okay. Do you have any advice, Joyce?
Well, I guess the question, maybe the big question is, if he's the pusher, in a sense, pushing himself, constantly pushing himself, maybe just having his wife or his partner say, what are you trying to prove? What are you trying to prove, and who are you trying to prove it to? Because even that, those two simple questions will cause at least some reflection to happen, because that's, you know, that's the big driver. That push may be that constant need to push and therefore validate, get more of that external validation that I'm okay, and I'm needing that from someone externally. So I think just raising that question, what are you trying to prove and who are you trying to prove it to?
Yeah, I doubt he would respond to that.
Well, maybe he needs a little more help, I would say. You know, I don't attempt to be, I'm not a psychologist and I'm not a researcher. And, you know, someone like a Dr. Clance, who did that formal research, has worked directly with people who can't. So maybe he needs that kind of professional help in terms of discussion if he's not willing to, you know, really step back from it and really look at himself in as I say, the clear light of day. Maybe it's a little more help that he needs, somebody, an independent and unbiased third party.
Are there any support groups for partners of people like this?
I don't know of any. I would say maybe that's a good one to have your friend maybe shoot an email. Dr. Clance has a website, Dr. Rose Clance, and she may be able to provide guidance in that direction. I really don't know.
I thank you very much. I will suggest.
Much.
And how do you spell that, Rhodes Clarence?
Last name is C-L-A-N-C-E.
C-L-A-N-C-E.
Pauline Rose Clance, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Mary, for that call. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for us or like to share your experience. Joyce, we lost a caller who was waiting on the line. She wanted to talk about feeling imposter syndrome, not in the area of work, and I think we've been talking about it more in a professional context, but as a wife and a mother. Do you have any similar stories in your book or advice for someone who feels like an imposter in the home?
I'm trying to think if there are any examples specifically in the home, but the imposter syndrome plays itself out in our personal life as well as in our professional life. And in fact, in my own story, when I decided to do the book and trying to reflect back, and I had a collaborator, Alex Kopelman, who worked with me on the book, and we started, he asked the question, when can you think back when you first really felt that way? And as I thought about it, it was when I was in high school, and I was I grew up in a family of modest means, and all of a sudden in high school, I was in class in a school where most of the kids' parents were professional. They were teachers, they were doctors, et cetera. And so therefore, from the personal standpoint of engaging with them, you know, it was that here I, you know, I maybe I don't measure up from a personal standpoint. I think also there's a story in the book from Ron Parker where now this is the negative side of it, where in fact his work was compromising his personal life, you know, his family. He was spending so much time on this question of fitting in terms of his job and career that he was compromising his personal life. So mine was that I felt just in terms of the imposter syndrome when I was in high school, I felt like I had to pretend to be somebody I really wasn't in order to fit in. And I think that's where probably this particular caller is talking about, is that, you know, is she measuring herself in terms of how good a mother she is or how good a wife she is based upon some profile that either has been drilled into her own head or that she assumes presents the perfect one of those. And she's definitely comparing herself to that and feeling like she's lacking. And I think some of the same techniques is, you know, wait a minute, step back. What's unique about you? What are the qualities and values that you're bringing to this family that are uniquely you, that are valued by your family? And it's the same thing as you do from a business standpoint.
Right, and motherhood, being a parent, is not something that is taught necessarily. There are a lot of books out there, but there's not one single textbook we all study from. And I guess we could call it June Cleaver syndrome.
That's right. Yeah. You know, they don't give you a degree for it. They just kind of say, okay, you're supposed to know this, and you're supposed to be great at it, by the way.
Yeah. Well, you have referenced your friend Edward Whitaker. He's the former chairman and CEO of General Motors and retired chairman and CEO of AT&T. He wrote the foreword to your book. And one of the lessons I took away from it was that he essentially said that getting along with others and truly understanding people is more important than feeling confident in your own abilities. Am I getting that right? And do you agree with that?
Well, it was interesting in talking to Ed because he voiced to me when I talked about the book, when I contributed to that book and talked about the imposter syndrome when I didn't even know the term. And he said to me, you know, Joyce, this isn't just something that women deal with. I've dealt with this most of my career. So I was shocked because he's, you know, you would never suspect it. He's a big, tall, exudes confident Texan. And so when I decided to do the book, I reached out to him, and he agreed to do the foreword for the book. And I said, well, tell me your story. And that's how I learned about, you know, he grew up with a family, you know, modest means. I think his dad definitely did not graduate from high school. I'm trying to remember. I think his mom did. And but he said that as he got into the workforce, he learned a lesson very early where he was so concerned about, he was in kind of a manager, low manager level, and he would, hide in his office because he didn't really know how to engage with these much more experienced workers that he had. And his boss took him down to the floor and kind of said, you know, you need to be there. This is where you learn, is you learn from your people. And he said that lesson stayed with him his entire career, that whenever he felt like he was in a new position and those questions about whether or not he knew enough or was in, you know, could fit in that new role, he realized that his greatest asset and his greatest value was his people. And so he said, and I learned that if I listened to my people, I'd learn everything I needed to learn, and that how that served him so well in terms of countering when, in fact, he was moving and then questioning whether or not he fit.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Randy in Sauk County. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Boy, I wish I would have been privileged to hear this 40-some years ago when I registered for college. The lady looked up at my dad and I, and standing there at that time, your parents took you to register, if you can imagine. And she said, they're looking for some people in the band, and you should go try out. And then she said it would be a full-ride scholarship. Well, one eyebrow went up on my dad, and he said, where is this music building? Well, long story short, I went and tried out and got the scholarship, and, of course, my life changed. I loved being in the band, but I never felt I was good enough to major in music. I just felt, oh, these people are so much better than me. And when I look back, I missed the, you don't realize until you're 50 maybe something that you should have done. And I just didn't feel good enough. And I ran across the band director one time and said, why in the world did you pick me that day? The line was long. And he said, look, you could have had a career in the symphony or whatever. He said, it's not my job to wet nurse you into feeling good about yourself. You did the best job for me you could. Well, I think I was a farm kid, and all those other kids were from Chicago. I don't know, and I was standing there, and I just, lo and behold, 2 hours later, they posted the name, and there I was, and I should have majored in music and didn't. I just didn't feel adequate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, boy, if I would have heard your message, I think it would have helped me deal with that, and I realized so much. I should have majored in music and been a high school band director at the college level or something like that. It would have been a much different life, but I would have enjoyed it.
Oh, well, you have given the classic example, actually, where that fear of not fitting in or not being good enough didn't allow you to really internalize that value that someone else actually saw, but you could not see. So, wow.
Well, that kind of strikes a nerve that I try to point out to friends and family and even coworkers when it seems like we're so, I guess, engrossed by the stress of daily life that we forget to take a step above that and think about if we were to look back on our life 20, 30 years from now, will we be regretful that we didn't take that first step toward moving in the direction toward happiness? And what would your advice be to someone who might be stuck in that cycle?
Well, I think basically it's that, you know, really looking honestly and objectively, almost like if you said to yourself, okay, I'm gonna allow me to be somebody else, and I'm gonna look at me under that with that same screen, you know, with that same unbiased evaluation of what do I think are the strengths and what do I think are the weaknesses, what are the experiences, what are the accomplishments, and really be able to honestly take that assessment of self the same way you do of other people. And then, you know, be able to take that, because that joy, that comfort, in a sense, that comes with really feeling like, I'm going to say, you're good enough, is something that we all need to strive for, that, yeah, we're going to continue to drive and get better, but it's not that, you know, that you have more negatives than the people at which you are engaging with or competing against. It's just that you have different kinds of values, or you have different kinds of skills, maybe, than this one, but you've got strengths on the other side that maybe they don't have.
Mm-hmm.
So just like we can look at other people and make those assessments, we need to learn how to look at ourselves and make those similar kinds of assessments.
What have you found to be good motivators for getting people to actually drop what they're doing and really think about these things today?
I think a good motivator is it can be a negative motivator when you realize that, in fact, you are not being your authentic self, that, you know, you're parking who you are at the door every time you go out, and that you are not giving your full value because of a fear of maybe not being accepted or acceptable. And so that first question of, is it the authentic me that's going out and engaging with these people or this group each time, or am I holding something back? And just taking some time to take a deep breath and be with self for a little bit, to really honestly understand that, because when you aren't bringing that full self to the party, that's where you rob yourself of that joy that you get from what we do every day. But it is that piece of really understanding what am I driving for, and am I doing this, and am I really being, is it me? Is this the authentic me that's coming to the party?
Well, Joyce, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. It's just really been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it, very much so.
So have I. Joyce Roche is the author of The Empress Has No Clothes, Conquering Self-Doubt to Embrace Success. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley produced this program, and thanks as well to Rhonda for on-air production and direction. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn, and I'm here all week right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.